Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 9th of October 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I'm afraid we don't have Dennis Wise with us this week. He's been taken ill once again. It's not the condition that he has. I think he's come down with a heavy cold, something like that. Obviously, we hope it's not COVID. Hopefully, he will be back next week. But we do have a special guest with us. We have somebody who I've had on the Daily Nationalist a couple of times to discuss the Spanish Civil War, because he's just translated a book on that. He also does research on the war in Japan. And he's come here tonight to talk about the Kabbalah and Sabbati Zivi and the growth of the Kabbalah and the Jewish secret societies, and that is Didymus Sumidid. Didymus, good evening, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back, and it's an honor to fill in for Dennis.
Well, it's great to have you on. I think this is a great subject that you suggested, and you've come up with some really good notes here that we can use, which I think we can branch off from and have quite a good discussion on a lot of these subjects. What got you interested in this? Were you translating another book or doing some research in particular in this on this subject?
Yeah, you know, I'd been interested in the Jewish question for a long time, and I'm not quite sure how I stumbled onto this subject. I know I heard the guys on Myth of the 20th Century, that podcast, so one of them mentioned the Frankist and the Sabbateans offhand one time. And I think I heard about it on Daryl Bradford Smith's I Am the Witness podcast. It's not he's not around anymore. He's still alive, but he doesn't research. But he's got archives up on the Wayback Machine. And so I think I heard about the Frankist and the Sabbateans through those two sources and a couple of others. And then I found a book on it's called From Frankism to Jacobinism that was written by Gershom Scholem, the German-Jewish researcher on Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism. He wrote this book originally in Hebrew in the 70s, and then it was translated into French in the middle to late 70s. And so I got a hold of a copy. I got a hold of the French copy and translated it into English, and I'm selling that right now on Lulu.com. And it's not the greatest translation, but the subject is so important and so interesting that I think it's worthwhile anyway.
Oh, it's a great subject, and it's really interesting looking at what these crazy Jews got up to. This Sabbati Zevi, I've really enjoyed reading about him today, claiming that he could fly and marrying this whore, and all the rabbis were furious with him, but all the Jews were following him as he was claiming to be the Messiah. It's quite fun stuff just to research basically the craziness of it all. But it all goes back to the Kabbalah and this mystic interpretation of Judaism, and you've got some really good notes here that go right back to the beginning. So if I just start by summarizing these notes, and then I'll branch off for your comments. The first one you say, we had started off with the biblical Israelite religion. Old Testament Judaism is sometimes what it's called, but it's not really Judaism at all. It was basically the Hebrew religion. And Judaism is really what came about after Christianity. Talmudism or Rabbinism is also known, is basically what Judaism is. It's rabbinic Judaism. And that started to form when the Jews came back from Babylon, or when the Judeans came back from Babylon. And basically it was the Hebrew religion, but with lots of bits added by man. Jesus called it the commandments of men, basically, and it was nullifying the Old Testament. Then we get to Christianity, and the Hebrew, many of the Hebrews became Christians, and then we also had some of the Judeans who didn't become Christians. Majority of them were Edomites, which is the type of person that Herod was. A lot of the Pharisees were Edomites, so they didn't become Christian. What they did, they developed this system of Judaism. They ended up codifying the Talmud, and the Talmud was written, I think it was written around about 400 AD, 500 AD. It wasn't actually put into text for 300 years after the New Testament was formed and written. So it was really in In response to Christianity, Judaism was actually formed, and the essential claim of Talmudism was that the wisdom of the rabbis is greater than God and the patriarchs, leading to them making endless generations of new law. Because, and also this is really where democracy comes from, people just talking about things and saying, well, we can change this law, and they would have a vote, and the rabbis would say, well, so many of us rabbis have voted for this, now we can change this law because we're actually greater than God, and the Jews themselves can be their own Messiah. And this is essentially the difference between Judaism and what went before, which was Hebrewism. And Christianity claimed to follow on from the Old Testament, which it does, and the Jews, they claim to really have this oral teaching which is superior to the Old Testament. They ignore the rest of the Old Testament. They only look at the first five books, which they leave on the wall of the synagogue in a scroll. They don't actually study that, but they look at the rest of it. So this was the forming of the Talmud, and from there we get to the esoteric side of it. But this is essentially where it all began. Do you want to add some comments to that, Didymus?
Yeah, you know, we could talk about just this part of it all day, and since we're not going to do that, we have to move on, so I won't say too much. But it's just it's very interesting about how there's these different stages of the development of this religion, which starts out as what we, you know, most, what you would say the average Christian understands Judaism to be, which is the worship of God through those first five books of the Old Testament, and then the historical material that comes after that, explaining what happened to these people who were Israelites or Hebrews or Judeans, not Jews. And so there's not too much more, I guess, we should say about that, other than one of the things I wrote down was that there were other, you know, contenders for who was going to be the non-Christian claimant to this tradition. And the Samaritans had a big revolt against the Byzantines two or three times, and they got beaten down. The Karaites, for whatever reason, remained a small and not influential minority. The Sadducees had their political power broken when the temple was destroyed, so they didn't go anywhere. And then I'm guessing that a lot of the Essenes converted to Christianity. So the only guy left standing, for lack of a better expression, were this Pharisaical nomadic tradition that used the words of men, right, rather than the temple. And would you like to say anything else before we move on?
Yeah, I'll just add something about the Essenes. I would agree with you there that I think the Essenes would have become Christian. The Essenes were the sect that rejected what the Pharisees were doing. They rejected the proselytizing of these Edomite tribes and making them into Jews. They rejected all of that, and they followed the Old Testament strictly by the book. They also used the Book of Enoch. So they were essentially the ethno-nationalists of their day, and they lived in a separate sect in Qumran, which is where we get the Dead Sea Scrolls from. And I would have assumed that they became Christians. They were pure Hebrews. That they rejected all this race mixing that was actually going on in Judea. The Karaites, they claim to stick with just the Old Testament, don't they? And I think there are some of them still around today, but they get pushed out by the Talmudists. Essentially, the Talmudists won this battle for who was going to be the opposing side, as it were, between the Christians and the other ones that were left. Is that how you would put it?
That's how I understand it. And so once they won that struggle, they then, you know, took over all of the different diasporic Jewish communities all over the world. And some people think that the diaspora only happened after the Second Temple was destroyed, but that's not the case. There were already Jewish colonies in Egypt, in Rome, in Spain, North Africa, and Anatolia and Greece. They already had colonies all over the place. And as to whether these were, you know, how racially mixed they were, I don't know. And they probably wouldn't tell us even if they did know, just because of the implications of that. But at any rate, the Talmudists had footholds everywhere. And what they did was they set up trade networks. And the Muslims talk about it, and the medieval European chroniclers talk about it. They would have trade routes that would go from Spain all the way to China. And so they could do trade cheaper and more efficiently than their competitors, at least for these long-haul voyages for, you know, exotic or luxury goods, really valuable things that were small, like silk or incense or gems or gold. So they dominated that kind of trade. And of course, after the Muslims showed up, they worked closely with them as the Muslims conquered Christian areas and westernized European types areas. The Muslims and the Jews would always work together militarily and economically, and that's part of the reason why the Muslims were so successful, is that they had all this Jewish help. But at any rate, at some point, they developed this mystical esoteric tradition that today we call the Kabbalah.
Can I just add something there? I would just say, before that, when you were talking about the diaspora and the places that they had this diaspora, one of the places was Alexandria. And that was where we ended up with the spurious Gnostic Gospels. And a lot of Gnosticism was coming out from Alexandria. And Gnosticism forms a part of the Kabbalah. So, I mean, you could really trace this esoteric idea that goes back to there, and that would have traveled with them. The same ideas that they put into those Gnostic Gospels came out again later on, as we'll get into in a bit. But I should imagine they were collecting little bits from the occult all over the world, wherever they were on these merchant routes. And I mean, this is where the term merchant comes from, because they were always merchants. I mean, going back into the Old Testament, the Canaanites were merchants. That's always been what they're named by. There's that famous Egyptian image of one of them rubbing his hands together, and it's quite clear, you know, this image of the merchant has been with us for thousands of years. But I think that the Kabbalah, this esoteric idea, we can trace it back to Babylon. And even though there wasn't that much of it in the Talmud, those ideas were still percolating and circulating, but they just hadn't been codified in the same way that the Talmud was. I mean, that's the way that I see it anyway. Would you agree with that?
I would completely agree. And I'd like to mention my friend. His name is Michael Joseph, and he has a website called Rockstar Esoterica and a YouTube channel. You can find it through Schism 206. And he's done a lot of research into Philo of Alexandria. And I think you and he would agree about this, that Philo is really the connection between the Babylonian magical, you know, Babylonian mysticism and what we would see later in the Kabbalah, is that you had a few people like him who were fusing the Western esoteric traditions, like what you had in Hellenistic Greece with the Hermes stuff and that sort of proto-alchemy tradition. And then the Eastern stuff, both of that, those things merged together through people like Philo and became part of the Jewish tradition, and then eventually would emerge in a different form later as the Kabbalah. But yes, as you say, they were picking things up all over the place and doing sort of a cosmopolitan synthesis, as it were. And those things just sort of moved around and, you know, recombined in different forms until eventually it became the Kabbalah.
So then we, but go on, continue.
Go ahead. So the Kabbalah emerges as a recognized thing in around the 12th or 13th century in northern Spain and southern France. That's the first time we have any real evidence of it. I guess I should say the western coast of Spain and southern France. And what they did was, these rabbis would come up with this book and they would say, look, this book is 1,000 years old and I'm the one who found it. And I'm the guy who really understands all the secrets that are in this book. And of course, it's all spurious. There's nothing to it. They wrote this stuff themselves. You know, they didn't find some secret magical tome somewhere. But like we were just saying, they probably were bringing together all of these prior strands of mysticism.
Can I just add something? I'll just add something there as well. I mean, later on, we get the spurious Book of Jasher that they pulled out from somewhere. And there were various other books that they tried to say were apocrypha, and they were Old Testament books. And they would pull the wool over the eyes of some of the churchmen. In later years, these rabbis would say, "Well, we've got this old tradition, and we've found these scrolls," and the churchmen would believe it, and they would even go to these rabbis for their translations. But so you think this is the first time that they were really started pulling these scrolls out and saying we found these old scrolls from somewhere around about 1200? Would you say?
That is, as far as I've read from studying, you know, like the mainstream scholarly texts on this, that's when they date the first main Kabbalistic text to, is around 1100 or 1200. But as you say, you know, this is probably something that they didn't invent at that time. Maybe they had been doing that already for 800 or 1,000 years, and this is just like a major breakthrough that they made where it was much more successful than it had been previously or later. So they used this as a sort of social technology in which the rabbis who promoted the Kabbalistic ideas could claim authority over other rabbis. And so you've got one rabbi who all he does is teach Talmud in his yeshiva, and he's got his students, and everything is done out in the open where they just argue with each other over the minutiae of this text. And they basically use sort of like a perverted reason and logic, because it's not really reason and logic. It's just hair splitting. It's pilpul. But then the Kabbalist can come in and say, well, I've got a deeper interpretation than any of this stuff that you guys have, and I have the authority of this ancient text. And guess what? It looks like a bunch of nonsense poetry, but I'm so smart and I have such a strong spiritual connection to the power of God that I can read this and interpret it for you. And maybe I'll only show you a few pages of it, right, just to prove that it exists. So they developed all these tricks and tactics, essentially, that they could use against each other, these rabbis, until over the course of about 250 years, all of the rabbis had to become Kabbalists, because essentially they had to protect themselves from these kind of attacks from the other rabbis.
I'll just add there as well about the way that it's done, the way that they would look at letters and say that these letters in the words had a numerical significance, and you could add up the letters that were in the word, and whatever the sum of those letters were, any other word that had that sum could be substituted there. So they could effectively just change whole verses around and say that in actual fact it means something completely different based on this numerology that they were using. Was that a part of it at this time, or did that come later on, do you know?
That would have emerged around the same time, sometime between 1100 and 1400. And you can see how this works. You know, in the Old Testament, in the Pentateuch, the first five books, everything is pretty clear. You know what God wants, and you know what his people are supposed to do. And if they do it, they do well. And if they don't do it, they're punished. It's pretty straightforward. Well, the Talmud, it invents these tactics to where we can try to weasel out of what God asked his people to do. And then by the time we get to this, you can totally invert the meaning. You can say that the opposite meaning is the correct one, and that anyone who goes for the most direct, simplest reading of the text is actually some sort of fool or naive person. So this is when they really start to get further and further away from the original, you know, Israelite or Hebrew religion as most Christians would understand it today. And this, of course, is going to lead directly into what you were talking about earlier, which is the antics of Sabbatai Zevi.
Yeah, I did enjoy reading about them. But go on. I was just going to say, I'm just looking at these, getting these notes here, and you were saying, but just about around about 1500, they were all doing this. They're all Kabbalists, and they're all coming out with these different occult interpretations of the Bible with this competition that they had. Now you move on to Messianism and antinomianism, and I just wondered if you could define both of those for the listeners before getting into the next bit. Is that possible?
Yeah, so Messiah, you know, Moshiach, I guess in Hebrew, or Christ in Greek, it all means the same thing. It means anointed one, if I remember correctly. That's the meaning of that word. It just means one who's anointed with oil. And after you can read the Christian interpretation of it and say that the Messiah is supposed to be Jesus Christ, and he came. Okay. Well, the Jewish interpretation of it is something different, because after the temple is destroyed, they believe that there's going to be one or two messiahs, depending on the interpretation. And one of them is going to be like an earthly political king, and one's going to be a military ruler. And together they're going to bring the Jews back to Jerusalem and overthrow the power of Rome or the Goyim or the Europeans or whoever it happens to be, and institute a millennial age. And so the Jews have a lot of prayers that refer to this. I think they have one prayer that they commonly use, which is next year in Jerusalem, which is to say that, you know, a year from now, they're going to finally be restored to their proper place as they see it in Jerusalem. And so messianism is just the belief that there is a Messiah and that he's going to come and he's going to deliver our just deserts. And it's not restricted just to Judaism. It's a general thing. But as these people would see it, it means that they ought to be waiting for a Jew who is going to come and restore them to that proper place, which is control of Jerusalem and probably world domination, honestly, is the way it's often interpreted by them. Antinomianism is a difficult thing, but you can just basically interpret it as it's the inversion or the perversion of moral values. What is bad will be good, and what is good will be bad. And the idea that will lead into Sabbatai Zevi here is that he merged these two things, in that when he claimed that when he came as the Messiah, that the old moral law of how you're supposed to behave will be subverted and overturned, and that the good will become bad and the bad will become good. And so therefore, you will not be held to the previous moral standards that dictated your community, your political and social life, and that instead you'll be able to do basically whatever you want. That's what those two topics mean.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'll just add, I think the term Messiah, I think originally it came from Meshech, which was the name for the crocodile in the Nile, and the oil that they would use from this crocodile they would anoint their kings with, and the anointing oil took over the name as the anointed one. And I think that's where it originally came from. And obviously, as you point out, that they wanted this leader that was going to lead them to take over the world. The Bible teaches that if you obey God, then Christians will be given the world, or the Israelites will be given the world if they obey God. Whereas the Talmud says, don't obey God, and I'll tell you how you can take it over for yourself. And that's the basic difference between it. And it was a big fear right up into the 1950s, 1960s. And it was seen that because the Jews were the opposing force to Christianity, that was what they were all about, was taking over the world, basically. We did a podcast with Dennis a few weeks back. I'm trying to remember the title of it, but it went into quite some details of the earthly kingdom is what the Jews were trying to make their own, whereas the heavenly kingdom is of Christ with the heavenly Jerusalem and all these things we read about in Revelations, whereas the Jews were trying to do that in the here and now and take it for themselves in the here and now. And this was this drive that was going on there, that this Sabbatai Zevi managed to tap into. And one of the things he did was to reverse the feasts around. So instead of fasting, he was telling people that they should be feasting and getting drunk. Instead of being ascetic, they should be being licentious and having drunken parties. And these rabbis weren't too happy with that. I think he tried to make his birthday into a feast day as well, and abolish some of the original feasts of the rabbis. Because by this time, it wasn't the Old Testament stuff that he was overturning. It was even the rabbi stuff that he was overturning, the Talmudic instructions, which they weren't happy about. But please do continue, Didymus.
But that's exactly right. Everything you said, that's exactly how I understand it. And so there's like this constant overturning of the previous in Jewish thought, and it never ends. It's still going on today. And this is why E. Michael Jones, the title for his book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, is so brilliant, is because like Trotsky said, they have an idea of a permanent revolution in mind. And Sabbatai Zevi is just one stepping stone in that. But then also the other thing you said about them wanting to establish an earthly kingdom rather than a heavenly or spiritual kingdom, they want perfection here on earth, and their view of perfection is quite different to ours. But Matt Johnson did a great podcast a year or two ago about Michael Higgert, and he wrote a book called The Jewish Utopia, where he describes this kind of stuff in detail. And it doesn't look too good for me and you, to be honest, right? It looks pretty bad for people like us. But at any rate, Sabbatai Zevi, he was born in the Balkans, and I think he had a mixed ancestry. It wasn't particularly Sephardic or Ashkenaz, and those things had split by this time, by the way. Before about the year 1000, there's not too much of an obvious difference between those two groups, but by this time, by the time he was born, there was. And so he's sort of a mixed Jewish character, born in Greece or the Balkans, and he goes on this wild tour. He was probably mentally ill, but he was highly charismatic. And he went all throughout the Levant, partly into Europe, North Africa, went to Alexandria, went to Palestine, went to all these different places, and built up an enormous following of at least tens of thousands and possibly hundreds of thousands of Jews who got on board with him and said, this guy really is going to be the Messiah. He's going to bring all this great stuff to us. We just need to follow him. And there are even letters extant from the period, from the 17th century, about Jews in Holland and other places basically selling all of their worldly goods and converting all their capital into liquid assets so that when he did institute the new Jewish capital in Jerusalem, they could pick up and move there. And they were laughing at the Goyim, you know, and being really rude about this time because they thought that, you know, their paradise was finally about to arrive. But as you say, he got into all these difficulties with the rabbis because he was overthrowing their stuff pretty much completely. And then he finally ran afoul of the Ottoman sultan, who called his bluff and said, either you're going to convert to Islam or I'm going to kill you. And of course, he converted to Islam. And that basically destroyed his movement. The entire thing collapsed. But you need to say something?
I think he was, the Sultan said, you can either prove that you're the Messiah, we'll fire loads of arrows at you, or we'll behead you, or you can become a Muslim. And he just put the turban on his head and became, right. And became a Muslim after that. But I think the Sultan found him quite entertaining at first, and he kept him on a revenue, and there were other Jews that would go out to see him. But just to take it back a bit, I mean, the first thing that he did, he said that he could fly, and then he got this big audience together where he said, because he'd said that he could fly, and then he said that they weren't pure enough to see him to actually be able to do it. It's like all yeah. things like this throughout. It's quite comical, and this whore said that she was supposed to marry him, this Dutch whore, and he called for her and she followed him and she became like his queen, this prostitute, where he was turning everything upside down, and obviously lots of licentiousness that was going on here. And I think it might have been around 1666, and I think that
that's
was
right.
666 was the time that they predicted that was when the Messiah was going to come. I mean, what a coincidence. It's going to have 666 in it.
It just feeds into their numerology and their gematria and all these other things. They're a slightly autistic people generally. They're highly neurotic and slightly autistic. And so things like that really catch their interest. And that was another reason as to why he was so successful. But also to comment on the sociological aspect of Jewish life, you know, you sometimes feel sorry for the little Jews because Talmudic culture and rabbinic culture absolutely crushes the little Jews. They, especially when they lived in the ghetto. The big Jews live high on the hog. They essentially have oligarchy as their natural political and social arrangement. They have a few people who are very rich and powerful. They have their servants, and then everybody else is essentially an underclass. And it's no coincidence that as soon as they get control of Western countries, that's what they try to implement on us. And that's why we hate it so much, because it's not our natural arrangement. But people like Sabbatai Zevi, when they get some power in the Jewish community, they try to break down these barriers, and all the little Jews get really excited and happy because now they don't have to be crushed by the rabbis anymore. And you could see, you know, maybe 300 years later, 250 years later, that's a big reason as to why all the Jews become communists and anarchists and social revolutionaries, is because they really want to get out of the ghetto and they hate the rabbis and they would rather just go burn everything down than to continue living like that.
Yep, makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? I mean, it does make a lot of sense. And the way that their system, which is basically what we're having to live under now, is just not natural to us. But it is natural to them. We can see that throughout history. I would recommend that people just look up the Wikipedia page on this Sabbatai Zevi, because it is entertaining learning about him. But then after that, when he collapsed, people were still going out there and were becoming Muslims, because I think what he said was that was all part of the plan. And this was part of the reversal of everything. You had to then become a Muslim as well after being a Jew. And then I think, or it might have been the next one, I can't remember if it was Jacob Frank or it was Sabbatai Zevi that said, and then there was another religion after that. So you had to become a Jew, then you had to become a Muslim, and then there was going to be a new religion after that. And there were still people that followed him right up to the end that were traveling from Europe to wherever he was, Constantinople, I think he was, to convert to Islam and become a Muslim. Oh, and he also had to marry another Muslim wife as well. He was given a Muslim wife as well as his whore queen. But yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Do continue.
It is. And so this guy, even though he was a failure, he didn't accomplish what he wanted to, and he didn't achieve what his followers thought he could, Nevertheless, he cast a really long shadow on history. And the basic ideas of messianism, antinomianism, and then this conversion or false conversion to other religions, these ideas stay around. And he didn't originate the false conversion. That had really gained massive prominence around 1490, you know, that time in Spain and Portugal, because both of those empires, or the Spanish and the Portuguese, both basically told their Jews, either you have to convert to Catholicism or you've got to get out. And there were a lot of them who didn't want to lose their money. They didn't want to liquidate their assets. And so they performed false conversions. And that really messed up things for the Jews who did make sincere conversions to Christianity, sort of poisoned the well in that regard, and created no end of trouble for those people for the next 200 years. But so he sort of picked up that idea of these false conversions and transmitted it through all of his followers. So just imagine, you've got this really charismatic cult leader, essentially, which is what he was, and he spreads these ideas throughout tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of European Jews, and who are fanatical followers of his, at least for a short time. And so now you can't get those ideas out because they're in there, right? They're baked in now. And this resurfaces in Poland about, what, 50 or 80 years later in the form of a Polish Jew named Jacob Frank. And he picks up several of these key ideas from Sabbatai Zevi and claims to be the reincarnation of Sabbatai Zevi. So in fact, you know, hey, Zevi didn't actually fail at all, because I'm back, I'm here, and this time we're going to do an even better job than we did last time. And he pushes the antinomianism in a different direction, whereas Sabbatai Zevi and his people did everything out in public. They would have, you know, big public feasts or orgies or just gigantic public celebrations. The Frankists, the people who are associating with Jacob Frank, or Jakob Frank, as he was probably called, they did everything privately. They were a secret society, and they performed, you know, really horrible acts like incest, child abuse, theft, murder. They basically did everything wrong that you can think of. And their idea specifically was that the more evil you do, the sooner paradise will arrive. They had the idea that committing evil acts will hasten the millennial age, or the full arrival of the Messiah, or the triumph of their Messiah.
I think one of the weirdest things with this is that even though they were like that, and the rabbis were against them, they actually had some protection from the church. And with this idea that they could just convert to these other religions, they were converting to Christianity, obviously not being Christians, going on with all this debauchery. But the church was saying, look at all these Jews that we've managed to convert. But they were actually these Frankists, and there were priests that were protecting these Frankists because they were against the Talmud. They burned a load of Talmuds at this time as well. And that was on the say-so of these Franks. And so they thought, well, these Franks are really good. And they're just like a different type of Christian, as it were. But they were totally, totally degenerate, even more degenerate than the last lot. So you can see that there's this real corruption of the church is starting to occur here now because of these guys. And I think at the same time, you then started to have these Kabbalistic interpretations of the New Testament and of the Bible. And there were a lot of Christian Kabbalists that started to spring up. I'm not sure if it was at this time, 1750, probably around then, that you started to have Kabbalistic exegesis of the Bible. And these Jews would claim that they accepted Christianity as part of the same sort of tradition. And I guess these Frankists must have been a part of that, because that was really big for a while, was Christian Kabbalah. And all the brightest minds of Europe were interested in it and were researching it. And they, like you pointed out, there were certain Jews that were trying to expose this, certain conversos that were genuine Christian conversos that were trying to expose this and saying, look, you shouldn't be applying the Kabbalah to the Christian Bible. But of course, they were ending up losing out because of the ego. Basically, there was a fight between Pfefferkorn, which was one of these converso Jews, and Reuchlin, and he was saying, look, you cannot be, Pfefferkorn was saying, look, this is all degenerate, you can't be applying this stuff to the Bible, and this Richelieu, or whatever his name is, was saying, well, this helps to interpret it, and they ended up not listening to Pfefferkorn, and listening to this Reuchlin guy, who was saying, well, I know how, I have a better interpretation of this, and this comes from the esteemed rabbis and what have you, and it was all falsehoods that started entering the church at this time. I mean, that's going off at a bit of a tangent, but it's you know, it's still to do with the Kabbalah, but not so much to do with the Frankists, or maybe it was. What do you think?
Well, it all has to be directly related, because it's the same ideas. It's just how they get transmitted. I think that the Kabbalah started invading European thought probably as early as 1400. And, you know, there were people in the Catholic Church in the late 1400s who were already getting instruction from the rabbis and creating this, you know, so-called Christian Kabbalah, which doesn't make any sense, right? There can be no such thing. Christianity and Kabbalism are completely incompatible. You can't believe both things at the same time, but that's what they call it. That's what they say. And those things started, they entered the Christian European West and the intellectual world probably in the 1400s. And so by the time you get to this era in the 1700s, it's already been there for several hundred years. And it forms the basis of all of the alchemy, the demonology, the witchcraft type stuff that these rich people would practice just for kicks or because they wanted to, you know, feel like they were more educated than everyone else. And it formed the basis of a lot of this. And people like, I want to say Isaac Newton, you know, even he was one of these guys who's thought to be a big precursor to science and part of the Enlightenment and all that sort of thing. But, you know, they were all practicing this alchemical, Kabbalistic nonsense.
And John Dee as well. John Dee with his Enochian keys, trying to conjure up what he thought were angels. I think that was a part of this as well.
That's right. So, you know, any of these guys that you dig into from that era, it seems to have been rife all over the place. It was in Poland. It was in Germany. It was in France. It was in England. It was all over the place. And the last podcast that you did with Dennis, where you guys were talking about the two different forms of Masonry, the English or Rosicrucian, and then the Continental form. You know, you can take this same argument and work it back through there and show that a lot of this Kabbalism is probably in with Templars and all of these other groups. So it's almost like there are different strands of this same thing. It starts in different places in different times, and they're all moving through history in parallel next to each other. And sometimes they jump over and, you know, cross-fertilize and create new strains of this disease that just keeps on infecting our thought as we go forward in history.
I think it played a large part in Freemasonry, didn't it? The Kabbalah and Kabbalistic doctrines ended up playing a large part in Freemasonry.
Well, we'll talk about that pretty soon, I think, or we could go ahead and talk about it now. Jakob Frank, whatever we want to call him, He was getting pressured basically by the Russian imperial government because of all this weird stuff that his people were doing in Poland. And so they moved to Germany, where the climate was a little, I guess, more open because of Protestantism. You know, Europe had gone through these religious wars, and so there was a little bit more religious toleration in Germany. And so they moved there. Actually, they moved to the Czech lands. They were in Moravia is where they went to. And they set up shop there. And he eventually died in that area, I think in Austro-Hungary is where he died. But they had, you know, several hundred or maybe a couple thousand of these people who were in this Frankist cult. And they were the elite of the elite because I guess they concentrated their money and wealth. And honestly, they may have already been connected with the Rothschilds at this time. It's not really known for sure. But they managed to get high positions in the Austro-Hungarian economic and political life. The guy that the book is about, the Gershom Scholem book that I translated, his name is Moses Dobruska, and his father was a big tobacco merchant in Austro-Hungary. The Jews had the monopoly on all the tobacco that was going to be sold in Austro-Hungary, and they paid their proceeds directly to the crown and the state. And so that gave them a direct personal connection with the emperor of Austro-Hungary. And that's just unfortunately what history is like for us Europeans, is that these people who are, you know, some of the worst on planet Earth are sitting next to our nobility, our monarchs, our elites, our rulers. And that's who they're getting advice from and working with rather than our people. And so that's unfortunate. But
what was he like? What was the Austrian-Hungarian emperor like, this one? Was he a good one, or was he a bad one? Was he infected with these ideas? Was he supporting the Jews, or was he standing up for us at the time? Do you know?
I want to say it was Joseph II. And so this is a guy that Hitler really admired because he was progressive and he wanted to bring Austro-Hungary into a time of strength and national unity, because, of course, they were broken up between five or six major different ethnic groups. And if you've read, you know, if for anyone who's read Mein Kampf, you know what Hitler thought about that. He thought the Germans were getting the short end of the stick and they were having to do all the work, and all the other ethnic groups were getting an unfair share of the benefit of German labor. And so Joseph II was trying to modernize the place. And, you know, if you're against progressive ideas like I am, this is kind of it's kind of a mixed bag, because progress and modernization can really be covers for things that are bad for us, right? Traditional European civilization is better than progress, quote unquote. But I think that due to their access to money and political influence, I think that's why somebody like Joseph II would have been willing to work with these Frankists. And so maybe his goals were good, and he was trying to achieve them by whatever means were at his disposal, and that was the basis of the relationship. But I couldn't tell you too much more about it than that. But that's the sense I get from reading it.
Right. So he was really just trying to do his best for his people. But when you've got these people, these other ones alongside you that are obviously very, very intelligent and seem to know a lot, and they're coming out with ideas that you've never heard of before, and you've got no resistance to them, they can quite easily break you down. I mean, this is how all the stuff that's going on today is going on, is because we haven't had a resistance to it. We haven't thought, well,
that's right.
Hang on a minute, these ideas, these people giving us these ideas, maybe giving them not for our own good, but for their own good. And of course, it gets put across as this is for your own good. This is, you know, this is diversity. It's a great thing. We want everybody to be friendly. Why wouldn't you want a man to marry another man? It's just love. You know, it's always put across as it's being a positive thing, and it's a great idea, and it's going to be wonderful for the community. And of course, it's not. It's to the benefit of the people that are giving it to us, not to our benefit. And I guess the same thing was going on here. He was probably dazzled by the intelligence of these people and the knowledge, that the secret knowledge that they had, because that plays into this as well. Anything that's secret, it has a gloss to it, doesn't it? And you want to find out about it, and you want a part of this secret knowledge. So I think that probably played in with it as well. Why people would
definitely Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you don't really know how much these European monarchs at the time actually knew about these people. You know, maybe they didn't really know the depth of it. They didn't know how depraved they were and what their motives were. And this Moses Dobrushka character, he and his family members, almost all of them converted to Christianity. And so therefore, the court, the European court, the Austro-Hungarian court, would have accepted them, because they thought, look, these guys are good Christians. They have a lot of money. They're motivated to work on our behalf. And they just really didn't know what they were all about or what they were doing. And so that's sort of the story about them, is that these people spread out through Germany, the Czech lands, France, and England, and they seemed to pop up everywhere in history after this. They also became highly influential in the Polish national struggle for independence. So the Frankists who did not move into Germany and the Czech lands, the ones who stayed in Poland, they supposedly converted to Christianity, they married Polish nobility, and they became part of the wave of revolutionary activists in the 19th century that were constantly rebelling against Imperial Russia. And that's a topic I haven't gone into too deeply, but it definitely exists and it's there. And so when you think about these national liberation struggles, when you think about the fact that they could possibly be controlled by these, these Sabbatean Frankist incestuous cliques or whatever, it really gives it quite a different cast to things like that.
Well, it shows that it has really deep roots, doesn't it? And this subversion has been going on for a long time. And they build up their numbers, they build up their wealth, they build up their power, they build up their prestige. And then before you know it, they're leading the revolution, or they're funding Gentiles to be the front men at the front of the revolution. And we see the same thing today with Gentile front men for things like Black Lives Matter or for Antifa. You know, the Jews will stay there in the background. They'll be the ones funding it. They'll be the ones encouraging it, but they're not necessarily always the ones that are leading it. More so they come out now and lead. But it wasn't quite so in the past, was it? I think the civil rights movement, they had a lot of blacks that eventually got really annoyed about this, that the Jews were leading from behind, and they were the ones that were setting all this up, and they wanted to do these things themselves. But they weren't as good at it as the Jews. They just have this revolutionary spirit which sets them apart from everybody else, and means that they're the best leaders for the revolution, unfortunately.
That's right. And so this character, this Moses Dobruska character, after he converted to Christianity, he changed his name to Franz Schoenfeld, and then he started to move in all of these Masonic circles in Germany and, North and South Germany both. And he and his friends, who I don't think most of them weren't Jews, most of them were Christians of one type or another, even religious men of one type or another, but who were seduced by these magical, you know, esoteric teachings, they formed basically Illuminist lodges. And they would colonize and invade the type of English, quote unquote, or Christian, quote unquote, lodges that already existed in Germany at the time. The Germans were basically imitating the English, and they would start their own lodges, and they would be fairly Christian and rationalist, is the way that Gershom Scholem describes them. They would be Christian and rationalist, and then Schoenfeld, Dobruska, and his friends would come in, they would get initiated, and then they would sort of pull a few influential members of the lodge aside and say, hey, you know, we got some really secret interesting teachings that you might want to hear about. And then once they would get two or three of the members in that lodge going, they would basically form a super lodge that would be above it. And they traveled all over Germany, north and south, and started inducting people in various lodges and creating this parallel network. Well, eventually the whole thing blew up because it was exposed. And so there was a big struggle in Germany between basically the exoteric, which is not quite the right word for it, but the exoteric lodges and the esoteric lodges. And this is, you know, again, it's exactly the same thing that you were talking about with Dennis on that previous show, in this struggle basically between the Grand Orient style and the other. I'm sure you have something to say about that.
I'm just wondering how the French Revolution ties in with this, around about what time? Because didn't he have something to do with that, or am I wrong there?
No, he definitely did. So after this episode with this work that he had been doing in these German lodges, he sort of gave up on that, went back to Austria, and then essentially became an agent for the next Austro-Hungarian emperor, which was Leopold II, if I remember correctly. And so as an agent of Leopold II, he then goes to Strasbourg and later Paris. And this is after the revolution has already started. So he starts to move in these the furthest left revolutionary circles in Strasbourg, and which are the Jacobins, right? That's where we get that name. They're the far left, most violent revolutionaries of that period. He starts to move in those circles, and he changes his name for a third time. Now he's Junius Frey, or Junius Fry, you know, for freedom. And he's got this faux classical name of Junius because, of course, the revolutionaries wanted to overthrow Christianity, and so you have to have something else to latch onto for culture, and so they tried to ape or emulate the classical period. And so he's got this Roman name of Junius, and he gets involved in this stuff, and he barely escapes Strasbourg, keeps his head on his shoulders. And then he goes to Paris with his brother and his sister, and they pretend that they have a lot more money than they really have, and they wine and dine all of these big-time French revolutionaries like Danton, Georges Danton, and he almost gets made a citizen of the new French Republic, even though, you know, he's basically never been to France in his life, and he's already meeting the top people in the revolutionary clique. And then there's a big financial scandal, and he gets his head cut off at the height of the terror. So the famous terror wipes this guy out, fortunately, but after he's already had quite an extraordinary career by that time.
And managed to change the ideas that were going on in these Masonic lodges as well, infecting them with these ideas. And it was from those lodges that this French Revolution was taken off from in the first place. That's where it all began, isn't it? With the mottos, liberty, equality, fraternity. Is it all these Masonic ideas that were finding their expression in revolution? And and obviously he's going to be thinking, well, that's where I want to be, in the center of this. But obviously he fell foul of it himself. I mean, rather like, I don't know, like a scorpion being stung by its own tail, I should imagine. You know, like the left will always end up eating itself, doesn't it? I think that's that
famous quote about the French Revolution, that she's like Saturn, she eats her own children. And so he got his just desserts. And as you point out, you know, yeah, he already injected these ideas in. And it couldn't possibly be a coincidence, could it, that the revolution was formulated, that the Jacobin work was being done in these lodges, and then you have the same type of guy coming from this Frankist Sabbatean perspective who also just manages to be in there at the time when all of this stuff is being done. It's highly suspicious, and honestly, the work that Gershom Scholem did, this book, it's not going to tell the whole story, because these type of people aren't going to leave all their records behind. And then even if these Jewish researchers find it, they're not going to expose it all to the public view. So certainly it goes even deeper than what we know. But just to find all of these influences all around here at the same time, it's the smoke of Satan, basically.
Well, we can tie in what I was talking about with Dennis last week as well, with the Templars and Jacques de Molay, and the Jacobins took their name from Jacques de Molay, and they were all kicked out of Britain. And when the Hanoverian monarchy took over in Britain, and the Jacobins were kicked out, and then they headed over to France. So you had their influence on the masonry there as well, as well as this Kabbalistic influence. So I guess you got a cross between the Kabbalah and the esotericism and the anarchists and the Bolshevik styles and the wanting to tear everything down. You got really just evil from all sides that is mixing together in this. When you think about it, you've got to understand the esoteric stuff, you've got to be incredibly intelligent. And yet to be wanting to destroy everything and to be an anarchist and be wanting anarchy, and it's usually something you would associate with people that weren't really that bright. And yet you've got the both of them working together here just to destroy everything, and just motivated by hatred. And you've got the more intelligent ones manipulating the less intelligent ones and telling them that everything's going to be brilliant at the end of this if you just destroy everything first. And it's the same mentality today with Black Lives Matter and Antifa. They've got no idea what they're going to put in place after they tear everything down. And now it's directed at white people. It's all directed at the racists, whereas back then it was directed at the aristocracy. It was directed at the church. It's moved on from that to all white people that it's now directed at, and we can feel that in everything that we see on the television and the public narrative. It's all about hating whitey. Eventually, I do think a time will come, the same as it happened in France with the French Revolution, and it will be just be white people. It will be open season on white people if things carry on the way that they're going. Do you know if there was, if like today, where we have all this mainstream media that's pushing this narrative, back then were there lots of pamphlets and newspapers and books that were pushing all these ideas, all these revolutionary ideas?
That one French priest who wrote the history of Jacobinism in France, I can't remember his name off the top of his head, but my friend Michael Joseph, he's the one who turned me on to that. He read the whole thing. It's an enormously long book. But in it, he talks about, in that book, that French priest talks about how these pamphlets would appear, you know, like spontaneously, and it would be a huge quantity of them. It was something that couldn't be done quickly, and it was way too expensive. And so it proves that there was big money behind producing that revolutionary propaganda. It's not something that, you know, little small-time activists were just printing this stuff up on their own and distributing it around the area where they lived and worked. It was a big operation, and exactly whose money funded it and all that, it's just not, it's something that's kind of lost to history. We don't really know.
I'm just thinking, I'm sure I read somewhere that Rosicrucianism started like that with the Rosy Cross, and there were pamphlets, esoteric pamphlets, that were actually put out, and that was the origin of Rosicrucianism. Do you know anything about that?
I'm sure that it was. I do know that the story that we've told here briefly about this Francis Sabbatean stuff, I know that there's another group that's similar to Rosicrucianism and part of Masonry called Martinism. And that was started by a Jewish converso named Martinez de Pasquale. And he was basically going out doing similar things where he was proselytizing these different lodges and trying to inject this Kabbalistic esotericism into it. He was doing that in France about 20 years before the period we're discussing here. So it was going on in different places at different times by different people, seemingly independently, but, you know, who knows how much they were connected.
And also, at this time with the French Revolution, that's when they emancipated the Jews. So, I mean, I should imagine that before this time, with the infiltration of the lodges, that all took place with conversos, with Jews that had claimed to be Christian and then brought these ideas with them into the lodges. Or were the lodges actually accepting Jews in at this time? Because Freemasonry really acted as a front for the Jews. And then the people from the Masonic lodges would make the changes in politics and what have you. But they were in actual fact doing Jewish bidding, and they always looked up to these Jewish ideas. So did they actually have Jews in these lodges, or were they just conversos that they were allowing in at this time? Do you know?
They would accept people like Moses de Bruschka, who was born and raised Jewish, but then allegedly converted to Christianity. And so that's how these Jews would get into these lodges. And I think that situation maintained for another 50 or 60 years until I think it was in Britain. I'm not quite sure. I think it was in Britain where the first, you know, professing Jews were actually allowed to enroll in lodges. For a long time, they didn't allow that, but they would allow these people who performed either a true or a false conversion to enter.
So we ended up with corruption of the church and also the corruption of Freemasonry through this. I mean, it's a strange thing. You know, you think, well, people can change or what have you, but it's probably only a very small proportion of these conversos that actually turned out to genuinely be trying to follow Christianity. They're outweighed by the large group of conversos that brought nothing with them but corruption and subversion and changed the church completely. I mean, a lot of people say, well, we've got to allow these people in, you've got to allow them to convert, but at what cost? You know, at what cost? There have been good ones, Ignatius Loyola, the Pfefferkorn that I suggested earlier, but they're outweighed, I think, 10 to 1 or maybe 100 to 1 by these no goods, basically, who are just using that as a cover. Do you agree with that, or what are your thoughts on that?
I do, and the worst part of it is that not only, you know, Orthodox Judaism is a problem for European civilization and Christianity. It functions sort of like a parasite on us, where it just sucks out money and provides degenerate influences. But then these guys, these Frankists, these Sabbateans, are like sleeper cells within Orthodox Judaism that are even worse. They're worse for the Orthodox Jews and for us, because you can't tell who they are, where they're going, what they're doing, because they're so secretive and so perverse. And we even know that people like Louis Brandeis, who was a United States Supreme Court justice, and Stephen Wise, who was basically the leader of the American Jewish community for 20 or 30 years, Brandeis was definitely a Frankist, and Stephen Wise, he probably was too. So how many of the other leading, you know, Jewish leaders and intellectuals and people who are basically directing all of the other Jews, how many of them are these Frankists as well? It's a big problem.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that they're still going. It's been really interesting to learn about the history of it right from the start, right the way up to the present day. So thank you very much for coming on today, Didymus. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back next week with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.